The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today has four cases set for oral argument, all of them by video conference. And we are ready for oral argument in the first case. I will call that case. The first case for oral argument today is number A23-1107, Alan Logelin versus Randy Pointer. As counsel likely know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will, in addition, have an opportunity for rebuttal argument of 5 minutes. You should be able to see a time clock on your screen if you have the right setting. One of the images on the screen is the time clock, which will count backwards. Please keep your camera on at all times, and if you are not presenting argument, please mute your microphone, as Mr. Orman has already done. With that, counsel for appellant, please introduce yourself and your clients, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is William Paul, PAUL, that's my last name. I'm an attorney from here in Duluth, and I represent Randy Pointer, the appellant in this case. As obviously, I'm sure you justices are aware, this is an adverse possession case in which the trial court, on cross motions for summary judgment, granted the respondent his motion for summary judgment and denied my client's motion for summary judgment. I am sure the court is well aware of the requisites for obtaining title, a deceaser to obtain title by adverse possession. But in order to go over those very briefly, I will summarize them. In order to establish title by adverse possession, the deceaser, the property claimant, must show by clear and convincing evidence an actual, open, hostile, continuous, and exclusive for the requisite period of time, which in Minnesota is 15 years. And as I set forth in appellant's brief, the time this action was commenced in 2022. So if you'd have to go back, and I'm talking about Mr. Logelin would have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he occupied my client's property no later than 2007. I respectfully submit that respondent Randy Logelin cannot satisfy any of the prerequisites, not even a single one of them, in order to satisfy the requirements for proving title by adverse possession. First,
Mr. Paul, what if we assume his affidavit to be true? Let's just take that piece of evidence by itself once. If we assume his affidavit to be true, has he then satisfied all the elements?
No. And here's why, Judge. The he in order for and I was going to get to that, but that just speeds it up. In
Right.
order, there has to be hostile possession of the property, Judge. And if you look at Mr. Logelin's definition, or excuse me, affidavit, he says, in effect, this is a paraphrase now, you can read it, but this is my interpretation. Gee whiz, I didn't even know I was on Mr. Pointer's property until he pointed it out to me in October of 2021. He says
Doesn't
it
doesn't
again.
the case law, I think the case law defines hostile in effect to mean using the property as if it were one's own. In other words, as if it belongs to the person acting and not belonging to someone else. And it seems like his statement about his, unawareness of the technical boundary line, is consistent with that.
Well, my reading of the law in that regard, Your Honor, is that it has to be to the exclusion of all others. And I'm going to quote from a 1972 case here, L versus Prosser, That's a Supreme Court case, which is 293 Min 183, 1972. And it states, similarly, the requirement of hostile possession does not refer to personal animosity or physical overt acts against the record owner of the property, but to the intention of the deceaser to claim exclusive ownership as against the world, and to treat the property in dispute in a manner generally associated with the ownership of similar type property in this particular area involved. And so I submit that even if you believed everything that is set forth in his affidavit, and I respectfully submit you ought not do that, because quite clearly, and this is always a problematic position for any attorney to take, but I frankly do not believe that Mr. Lodgelin is being truthful, and the aerial photographs prove that, but I'll get to that in a moment. But when he says, gee whiz, I was surprised, again, my interpretation, I was surprised to learn I was on Mr. Pointer's property and didn't realize it until he pointed out to me in October of 2021. That belies a suggestion that he was intending to use it to the exclusion of all others. Maybe he was
Wait,
using it.
Mr. Paul, though, if I could interrupt you, isn't
Sure.
that, I mean, there is adverse possession when there are border disputes. And just to clarify, there's no, both sides agree this is a border dispute. Is that your understanding?
Well, they share a boundary line, Judge. There's no question about that. And so it
But
all.
do is it your client's position that this is a boundary dispute, that there's confusion over what the actual boundary is?
Oh no, there's no confusion about where the boundary is, Judge. Everybody agrees that Mr. Lodgelin cross the boundary onto my client's property. There's
So,
no dispute.
did you raise that issue in the district court? What was your position in the district court?
It was not an issue in the district court. There was no argument made that the location of the boundary was anywhere other than the location of the boundary. Indeed, Mr. Pointer commissioned a survey, and it was never argued that the boundary line separating the adjoining parcels of property was 10 feet this way or 10 feet that way. It is purely a adverse possession dispute, and that is when Mr. Lodgelin went over the boundary line onto my client's property. Whether he did that long enough ago to claim ownership of a portion of my client's property by way of adverse possession. Judge, is that responsive to your question? So there is no dispute about where the boundary is, with all due respect. None.
So this is not a boundary line dispute case. Is that what you're saying? I
I
mean,
am.
I don't mean to be obtuse here, but that's, yeah.
That is what I'm saying. This is literally the first time anybody ever raised an argument that Mr. Lodgelin or Mr. Pointer disagreed about where the boundary line was.
But
It's
you never asserted in front of the district court that Mr. Loughlin failed to pay property taxes for
no,
Mr. Pointer's property.
nope, I never raised that, because that argument would not have flown under the law. There was no requirement that Mr. Lodgelin, under the facts specific to this case, because it's not a separate parcel, Judge. It is not a separate parcel of property. There's the Pointer parcel of property, and then there below that is the Lodgelin parcel of property.
I understand that. I'm just asking what you argued in the district court, but you did not argue that property taxes needed to be paid.
I did not.
So okay. And so then my next question is, the district court in its order, and the parties have presented this as being three separate areas. So are they actually separable with separate arguments? Or are there demarcation lines between the west, the east, and the central area? Or how,
No.
or is it just we're to treat this as one parcel so that if, or one portion, I guess, of your client's property, such that if we find that there was, you know, exclusive, open, hostile possession, for example, the septic tank, then you lose on the appeal.
Let's see. If you find, well, let me try to answer that question. The septic system was there in 2003. And when I say the septic system, a portion of the leaching field encroached upon my client's property. There is no question about that. Now, that Mr. Lodgelin in his affidavit indicates that, gee whiz, that was the septic system installer's fault. It was inadvertent. It was a mistake. And I would admit, as I did in the to the trial judge, that you couldn't see from an aerial photo the presence of the septic system just because the septic system looks like grass, just like on either side, all the way around it. With respect to the other uses that Mr. Pointer claims to have put the property to use, I direct your attention to the addendum of my client's submissions. They're pages 45 through 58. In those, Mr. Lodgelin claims that he built this, he built that, he had a pig pen, and he had a garden, and he had this, and he had that. Again, I do not believe, and I'm certain of it, that none of those structures were there when he says they were there. The very first aerial photo that shows anything was in 2008.
We've read all that. Go okay. Ahead, Judge Cochran.
But I was just going to circle back to your question, which I think is a very good question, Judge Siegel. So, counsel, assuming the septic system is a sufficient use to establish adverse possession, is that sufficient to establish adverse possession for the entire parcel?
I would certainly hope not, Judge. And Judge Johnson, the trial judge, asked a similar question. Does the fact that the septic system encroached on my client's property by some, and frankly, I cannot remember as I sit here, whether the survey reflects how much of the leaching field of the septic system encroaches on my property. But, you know, let me make it up. What if that's 50 feet, 50 by 50? Does that then permit a district court judge to rule that the septic system owner then gets an acre and a half of the property that, in this case, he encroaches upon? I would hope not. What if it would be 5 acres, you know, a little portion here, and it turns into 5 acres because Mr. Lodgelin has commissioned a surveyor to draft a legal description that's 5 acres big. In other words, I submit that these three different areas that were a product of the trial judge, but of Mr. Lodgelin, they're not treated as one big thing. They're all separate and distinct from the septic system and cannot be the subject of a global adverse possession award without clear, unequivocal, and convincing proof. And of course, you folks are aware of the burden of proof. It's clear and convincing. And every inference under the law is supposed to be interpreted against the claimant, the deceaser, in this case, Mr. Lodgelin. And I respectfully submit that the trial court erred in not following that burden of proof when it appears
so
to.
So I've got a question for you. So you're the only evidence that you put in response to Mr. Laughlin's motion for summary judgment was the affidavit about the from Mr. Kosky about the aerial photograph showing actual structures. Do you have any cases saying that if you make a garden, you know, which doesn't require structures, it's a clearing of land and, you know, planting things, that there has to be a structure? And I'm trying to figure out, is there a genuine issue of material fact? And it seems like the Kosky affidavit is really limited to testimony about what can this he can see in these very blurry aerial photographs, whether there's a structure there. But if it's a garden and there is no structure, isn't that an exclusive possession?
I submit not, because a garden, Judge, in my view, would not be continuous. A garden would be, by definition, seasonal. That's number one. Number two.
Well, do you have any case law making that kind of distinction? I mean, what about farmland then? You don't exclusively possess it because you only grow during, you know, 4 or 5 months out of the year?
I would have analogous cases like mowing. Mowing on somebody else's property cannot be the subject of a claim for adverse possession. So I would only
based on what? Is there a case? I mean, what case law should I look at then to help me figure this out?
Judge, I ran out of time, and
you may feel free to answer the question.
I do not have a case citation, but there are many cases out there that says sporadic use of somebody's a neighbor's property cannot be the foundation for a claim for adverse possession. But again, he claims to have used this, and there's zero evidence that he ever used it other than the septic system within the 15 years of the commencement of the adverse possession. There's nothing other than his affidavit, which I submit I ought to be entitled to at a minimum cross-examine him about, so that I can prove that he's not being truthful.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument. You are muted, Mr. Orman. Please unmute and then start over. You're still muted.
Okay.
Now we can hear you. So you please introduce yourself and your argument, and then you may begin.
Very well. I represent Alan Lodgelin. Alan is also was going to be here today from his country home by Canyon, and my associate Nancy von Segeren is also, I think, on the line. With regard to the comments that Mr. Paul made, just to directly talk about those, one is no structures. You don't need a structure in order to have adverse possession. He said every inference is going to be against the person who brings the motion for summary judgment. That's not true. We briefed
Mr. Orman, let me go back to your first point about whether a structure is necessary. Do you have any case law on that subject?
Structures are not required. It's in our brief, Your Honor, and with the limited time we have, but structures are not required.
Okay.
With regard to inferences, he said every inference is going to be against the party who brings a motion for summary judgment. That's not the law. That's also in our brief. Seasonal mowing is commonly a basis for adverse possession.
Where, again, it would be really helpful to us if you would cite to a case for that holding.
Sure.
Instead of generalities. And then
They are generalities, because we submitted all of this material, and I'm I'm assuming that everybody on the court had the opportunity to
We
review.
did read your brief, but if there's a particular case that says mowing isn't, then I would, if it's handy, and I don't want you to take up all
It
your
is
time looking.
not him, and it's not
Okay.
convenient to look it up.
All right.
But
And
I mean,
then I have a question
sure, go ahead.
about these three areas. So let's assume the septic system and perhaps a garden is, exclusive open hostile possession. But other areas, there's like hunting and trapping. How is that actual exclusive possession as opposed to some kind of a claim for an easement, the right to use property for the purpose of hunting? I mean, I'm not persuaded that your client has actually made out his or explained to me how that satisfies the burden of proof, even assuming that every statement in your client and Mr. Schmidt and the other affidavits are true. Should this really be divided up into an issue over specific areas based on the claims of use and possession of those areas?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but the elements of adverse possession has to apply to each of those three areas. And where you say that it's difficult to see how someone who is hunting on a particular piece of ground is hostile and exclusive. It happens that those are the facts. He's the only one. That is, my client is the only one that hunted on
Is
this
that
property.
in any affidavit that you submitted that nobody else set foot on that portion for hunting or for any other reason?
I believe it's in the facts that are recited with respect to the Eastern property that he trapped, he hunted. And I believe there's one other activity. Yes, he cut firewood in that particular area and recovered that firewood to burn in his house where he heats with wood. So it is the exclusive use. There is no
So,
opposing. I'm
looking at the
sorry.
affidavit, it says that he's used for the eastern area and western area. I'm looking at your addendum at page 32. It says, "I have used the wooded areas of the disputed property to trap bobcats and coyotes and to hunt." I don't see any statement that he excluded others from hunting there. So I too am wondering how hunting or trapping can be an exclusive use if you're not keeping others out of the area. Let's focus on that piece for a minute.
He's the only one there. And
How,
it
but it doesn't
did.
say that. It just says, "I have used the wooded areas of the disputed property to trap bobcats and coyotes and to hunt." So can you point me to somewhere else in the affidavit where it says he's the only one there?
Other than the facts, as they all go together, because these are fact-intensive cases, as the case laws indicate, that
And would
he's
you
the.
agree that at summary judgment, the court needs to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, or the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party?
Absolutely, and the case law is in the brief regarding that exact issue.
And then with regard to the gathering of firewood, he says he's cut down standing dead trees, including trees that were cut by beavers. But again, it's not clear to me how that demonstrates an exclusive use that no one else can use, that he's kept up his house or out or indicated that only he is using that property.
I believe that his affidavit and the information that we presented to the court indicates that he is the only one that's there. The other party that would be there is the defendant in this case, the Mr. Poynter, and he's never been there. In fact, he's only been there when he discovered that my client was trapping beaver, and then called the game warden, and the game warden said, put up no trespassing signs.
Is there anything in the evidence you submitted to the court when it ruled on your motion for summary judgment to say that Mr. Poynter had never been on the property? I saw the statement that he never raised an objection to Mr. Poynter never raised an objection to Mr. Lodgelin's use until later. But I didn't see anything that said that he was, that Mr. Poynter was never there in the evidence.
He was
and
there.
That's what we're stuck with on a motion for summary judgment, is what is specifically set out in the evidence presented to the court.
Mr. Poynter has indicated in the record that, for instance, he never had any knowledge that the septic system went in. In this particular case, we know he was on the property because he discovered a beaver trap over there that ultimately was was the tip off for everybody that he was on Poynter's property, record property in any case. An exclusive is not like nobody else is there. Exclusive is that he used it and no one else came in there to use it. For instance, he's using it exclusively with the septic system. He's using it exclusively with the rocks and pigs' pens and the various activities that are going on that are outlined in the three areas.
Moving rocks on another person's property, is there, I mean, again, are there any cases that say that that kind of thing shows you're in exclusive possession of that land?
Yes, if you're thinking about exclusive, like no one else is going to be there, I don't think that's what the law shows. I think exclusive means that they're the only one there. They're holding.
Also, in your brief, you cite on page 28 the Romans v. Nadler case.
Yes.
To summarize the elements of adverse possession. And that's at page 28 through 29 of your brief. And the last sentence is, the deceaser must not only claim adversely, but it must make the fact known, or as it is sometimes said, that he must keep his flag flying. So can you tell me what evidence in the affidavit, or where in the affidavit would you point me to show that that Mr. Poynter kept his flag flying, made it known that he was using the eastern portion of that property exclusively?
So the
or not the, the not the east the I'm sorry, maybe I'm getting it mixed up, but the portion of the, yeah, the eastern portion, the portion that he claimed to be using for hunting and trapping and firewood, but not anything else.
He continued to use it for firewood. He cut down trees. There were stumps there. You're looking for evidence of some
kind.
So
the stumps are the evidence that he kept the flag flying.
In terms of keeping your flag flying, it's that you've got to continue to use the property for this adverse purpose and continue to utilize it to satisfy the elements of adverse possession. I think the exclusive that you're thinking of is like absolutely nobody else is there. There's no fences. People could walk across it.
I'm just wondering, let's say someone has has a 40-acre piece of property, and their neighbor decides to go hunting on the back 5 acres. And that, you know, the 40 acres, the back five is not readily accessible from the other part of the 40. How does it become exclusive and open when it's, you know, hunting is something that you do kind of intermittently for a short period of time, not continuously. How does that hunting?
It doesn't satisfy the elements of adverse possession.
So how is my hypothetical different than the what is included in the affidavit here with regard to hunting?
Because my client did it more than 15 years.
Well, let's assume in my hypothetical they did it for 15 years. They hunted on the back 5 acres for 15 years, and they...
Yes, but this was, you know, a much more substantial use than what you're talking about when someone goes hunting in the fall. So it's a completely different use. Those people, whoever are hunting on your friend's land, simply don't have an adverse possession case based on the case law.
Can you clear up one question in the record I've got in my mind? So in the eastern area, your client used that for trapping and hunting and cut down trees for firewood. Is that right? Was there any firewood stacked on that, on the eastern area, or was that all stacked in the center area, the firewood?
I don't know exactly where it was stacked. Would you? I guess I'm not. I know there were stacks of woods, and I know that.
I'm trying to figure out what your client alleged his use was. And so there's evidence in the affidavits about firewood being stacked. My reading of it is that firewood was only stacked in the center area. Is that accurate to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, it would be both places. When you're cutting down this firewood, you're going to stack it. And then you're going to bring it towards the house because there were stacks of wood in the center area that were close to the house where they actually burned the wood. So my view is that having done this the requisite amount of time, that in fact, that is one of the contributing factors toward him having a right to adverse possession for this particular area.
Mr. Ormond, you may sum up if you wish.
Well, based on the material that we've submitted to the court, I think that we need to ask you to affirm Judge Harris's action, which took place on, and affirm the motion for summary judgment. And I wish I had more than another 15 minutes to talk about the various activities that Mr. Lodgelin has entered into on this property.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Orman. Mr. Paul, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument.
Thank you. I wanted to make mention of the survey. As you can see from the record, and I've prepared an argument about this, the rules of civil procedure require that with every motion for summary judgment, there shall be a recitation of material facts which are not in dispute. The motion paper submitted by Mr. Lodgelin at the trial court level did not include such a recitation. And so that kind of puts a responding party at a disadvantage because, as you all well know, the responding party then gets a chance to say, well, this is in dispute, that's in dispute, and this is in dispute. But one example is the survey. on information and belief, the survey that Judge Harris, the trial judge, eventually adopted, was commissioned either by Mr. Orman on behalf of his client or his client. And as you know, I brought a motion in limine because there was no disclosure prior to what was going to be the trial the following week or 2 weeks later, seeking to exclude any testimony from any expert, including the surveyor. And so I, to this day, I have no idea how the surveyor decided that 1.5 acres or whatever it is, whatever the dimensions are, how he got to that. And I would submit that at a summary judgment stage, I ought to be able and have the right to cross-examine that survey and say, hey, how did you determine? Well, you know, Mr. Lodgeland told me he used up to here and he used up to there and he hunted over here and he hunted over there. And when and I, then I marked all those areas off.
So when did you receive this? Was this survey done? When was it done? That's on pages 84 and 85 of your addendum. And when did you receive that? Was it produced in discovery?
I'm certain, Judge, it was produced during discovery. No question about it. But
so you could have deposed, the surveyor if you'd wanted to.
Well, no, because I think you're not entitled to. I might be wrong about this, but I don't think you're absolutely entitled to do discovery and take the deposition of the opposing party's expert witness. I think there has to be an expert witness disclosure. And as you can see from this record, there was absolutely no expert witness disclosure. Yes, there was a surveyor, but is it incumbent upon me then to say, well, Mr. Lodgeland, he's just not aware that he has to have an expert witness disclosure. And let me tell you, I sought several times, please tell me who your expert is going to be, and a summary of that person's opinion. And then,
Mr.
of course,
Paul, was this survey introduced for purposes of determining liability on the subject, or was it only used in order to determine the meets and bounds of the final order?
The latter, I think, Judge. And then after I wrote to the court, and I think it should be part of the record, you know, paraphrase, Dear Judge Harris, can we have an evidentiary hearing on the, you know, since you granted summary judgment, can we have an evidentiary hearing on the issue of the meets and bounds, to borrow your phrase, Judge? And then Mr. Okay. Orman wrote a correspondence. And then next thing I know is an order adopting the survey in its entirety was entered as part of the order, which is obviously tantamount to a denial.
Mr. Paul, what do we make of the fact that your client did not put in an affidavit? I find that a little bit surprising. In other words, you know, I'm wondering whether during the decade or more, during the relevant time period, whether he ever walked the perimeter of the property, whether he has any knowledge. It seems like we must assume he has no knowledge, no firsthand knowledge of any relevant facts. Is that a fair? Is that an appropriate way for us to analyze the summary judgment record?
Yes, Judge. And I frankly thought and continue to believe that the photographic evidence, which shows a complete, that Mr. Lodgeland was being absolutely untruthful to the court relative to his use of the property at least 15 years to prior to the commencement of the lawsuit, would carry the day. I also didn't think it necessary under the law that says a deceaser has the burden of proving by clear and convincing, unequivocal evidence all of the factors. What good would an affidavit from my client, and by the way, he answered, prior counsel answered, denying all of the allegations, and you're supposed to obviously take that in consideration on a motion for summary judgment, but should I, rhetorical, I'm not looking for an answer. Randy Poynter being first duly sworn, I never saw any activity on any of this property, and I didn't even know the septic system was on my property until I commissioned a survey when I discovered that he was hunting and trapping on my property, and the DNR told me to put up a no trespassing sign. Would that have made, created a fact issue different than the fact issues that I submit already exist? I respectfully submit it should not make a difference. Did that answer your question, Judge?
Yes, thank you. It appears you may sum up if you wish.
Here's the relief that I respectfully request. I ask that this court reverse the grant of summary judgment in favor of Alan Lodgelin. And I know perhaps this is a stretch, but it ought to reverse the trial court's denial of Randy Poynter's motion for summary judgment, because there is nothing in this record that would support a contention by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Lodgelin put this property to any use other than the septic system 15 years prior to commencement of the lawsuit. In the alternative, I'd ask that you reverse the grant of summary judgment of, in favor of respondent, and remand for a jury trial. And that's another issue, that am I entitled to a jury trial on this issue? And I hope you would address that on all the issues, including Randy Poynter's trespass claims. And that's how I would ask the court to consider ruling in this adverse possession case. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. The court will consider all of the issues in your appellate brief, regardless of whether they were the subject of oral argument. So the case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Have a nice day. See ya.